Before this episode starts, we just wanted to let people know that this episode was actually recorded before the final verdict for the Chauvin trial. So our initial reactions to that verdict and our thoughts are not going to be in this episode, but they're going to be included in what we are going to be now be calling a part two to this episode 16 Chauvin trial. And that's going to be coming out the day after that this episode is set to air. So that's going to be April 28th, 2021 at 8 a.m. EST. So we hope that you stick with us for that episode to hear our reactions and stick with us to continue the discussion that needs to be had for the fight for racial equality and the discussion that definitely needs to be had when it comes to addressing our criminal justice system. So thank you so much for watching. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever you're watching the Gradient Podcast. We're always glad to have you. Welcome back to the next episode of the Gradient Podcast. We're really two for two with the latest ones. So I'm Jaden, as always.
I'm Evan.
And I'm Arman. And first things first, we're here to talk about Bill Gates' cousin, Matt Gates. And I'm allowed to make that joke because we can make fun of child predators. Evan, what are your thoughts?
Well, first things first, I'm pretty sure that joke was explicitly stolen from SNL, but I'll let that slide.
Yeah.
But going on from that explicitly stolen joke.
He's not Bill Gates' cousin. He's just a horrible person.
Yeah. There's a Z at the end. That's true. That's how you know it's different.
With a Z, because he's hip, because he likes teens. Also stolen from SNL.
Stolen joke number two, ladies
number
and gentlemen.
Number two. Can we get a counter?
I just watched the episode like an hour ago.
Can we get like an Armand stolen joke counter or something? That'd be I think that'd be wonderful to have. But yeah, go. So right. You know, so Matt Gates, he is a representative from Florida, which is where the three of us are all from, and he's been in the news lately because he has been accused of trafficking a minor across state borders and for sexual misconduct. Pretty touchy, heavy subject, so we'll try to cover this with as much nuance as we can. But just the gist of it is Matt Gaetz, a congressman, a representative from the state of Florida, has been accused of sexual of human trafficking across state borders.
So we can't be, you know, for sure, we can't say for sure like if he's guilty or not now, but there is definitely some very hefty evidence against him. So I kind of want to start off by talking about, you know, if he were to be proven guilty, how do you think that's going to, you know, what should be the action taken by, you know, Republican congressmen and, you know, people and just conservatives in general? Like, how should they try and distance themselves from Matt Gaetz?
I think for the like whole idea of trying to keep the government as like pinnacle of like, I guess like role models in the sense, the entire like representatives have to undoubtedly like condemn him for his actions. He should obviously like be removed from office and given his consequence in jail, because he isn't above the law, or shouldn't be above the law comparative to any other citizen in the United States.
Mm-hmm. I think a good sort of frame of reference would be what a lot of Democrats have been doing with the recent allegations made against Governor New York Governor Cuomo, Andrew Cuomo, where they're asking for his resignation. They're trying to distance Governor Cuomo from the party as much as they can. I think a similar effort at least ought to be made from the Republican Party, from the GOP, in order to distance themselves from someone who could possibly be in the future a tried and what's the word I'm looking for?
Tried and true.
No, convicted child sex offender.
Right, and I think it just goes to show the flaws in our like governmental system. If currently multiple senators and or senators are representatives in Cuomo and
political figures.
Political figures are accused of these sort of crimes, right? Because the government should be the role models of our nation. And the fact that multiple of these people, it's not just like some anomaly, it's becoming more common, even with the Kavanaugh case years back. I think there is some sort of inherent flaw and something that needs to be addressed, whether it be a stigma more against this culture of like acute, like rapists and terrible people needs to change to make them like diminished more in terms of like status and whatnot. And it's horrible and something needs to be done about it.
So another issue, like, you know, I just found with this whole system is I looked into it, right? And until he's actually convicted, he can stay in that position for as long as he wants, right? And there have already been calls for him to resign. He said he's not going to resign, right? And then there have also been calls for, you know, him to be forcefully expelled or forcefully, the words here, yeah, just for Kevin McCarthy to expel him from the House, right? And what we've seen from both sides of the aisle, you know, in recent history is that they've had kind of extreme loyalty to, you know, their supporting cast, if you will, right? For example, when Andrew Cuomo, there were issues discovered about him, many of the Democratic congressmen said, we're going to wait for our justice system to play out, right? The same thing is happening now. The Republican side, when it comes to Matt Gaetz, is also saying, we're going to wait for this justice system to play out, right? But in the world that, you know, either of them are guilty, is it really the right thing to do to just let these people still sit in that position of power?
I think even when they're not, like, supposedly not guilty and it's unsure, the system itself is horrible, because whether they get convicted or not, the time before the trial takes light years, and even the proceedings of the trial of this high of, like, status is going to take a long time in itself, and the likelihood is he's going to be able to continue with this job in the meantime, right?
Come on, did you say it would take light years?
Sorry, I realized that as I said it.
I'm disappointed in you. My disappointment is immeasurable, Armand.
Not time. I meant to say astronomical unit. it'll take years minus the light for the trial to actually begin and for it to conclude is another span of a long period of time, right? And while they remain in office, the influence they bring is just terrible to the American public. The fact that while this possible sex offender is still able to create the laws to govern the United States is a nightmare for people who are more likely to be subjected to or like victimized by this sort of sex offense crime, right? Mm-hmm. So I suggest is if there is reasonable suspicion or reasonable backing behind these allegations, there should be some sort of clause where they should be suspended from their powers and then following the trial immediately like removed from office, and some sort of replacement presider will take their place in the meantime.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly about the scenario is that the trafficking of an underage woman is not the only misconduct that Matt Gaetz has been accused of. He's also been accused he's a member of the House of Representatives. I'm assuming it was on the floor of the House of Representatives. He was accused of sharing video footage from his phone of women of basically just, you know, a sex tape, effectively, just, you know, right. Footage of women he's having sex with.
That's activity you can expect at a bar of like the terrible, right. Terrible people in like the United States. It is the polar opposite of what you should expect from a governor. And the fact that this happened is so ridiculous, or even the fact that there's allegations suggesting it might have happened is such a ridiculous accusation. And the fact that it's like a reputable allegation, that's not the correct term for it, but you know what I'm saying, there's like basis behind this allegation, is it just shows how inherently horrible the electorate system is, right?
Yeah, this is by no means behavior that's befitting of an elected official, you know, someone who has been chosen amongst many, many candidates to represent a portion of our state of Florida. So that's something, you know, as someone who's a Floridian, I can't take pride in that by any means.
I mean, like you guys already said, you know, there kind of should, there definitely should be a clause where if somebody is indicted for like a really serious crime, they should be able to be, you know, removed from office. Like, whether or not the charge is true, like, even if like they are found not guilty, for the moment, people like that, like, the chance that there is true kind of should be enough where, you know, these people shouldn't be in positions of power. Because, you know, for example, Matt Gaetz specifically, there are like, I don't want to say the large majority of people, you know, don't support him now, because I don't actually know the true statistics. But for the people that still do support him still being in power, him still being a congressman, him still saying, oh yes, I'm innocent, those people are going to get more riled up and are kind of, I would say, are going to support him more at the end of the day, because he still has this position, he still has that power, and he's still able to kind of rile them up because, you know, he can show that he still has that power.
Exactly. I can't say like the exact conformity system with like any other forms of like the workforce in America, specifically because these individuals are in the spotlight. They're mainstreamly broadcast, and they have the power to govern a large majority of like the jurisdictions of the entire nation, like inherently, right?
Yeah.
If it were some other like individual in like some sort of workforce, right, like a grocery store or however it is, if a similar like accusation happened to them, I don't per se think that the right action is to immediately replace them with some clause while it's still like in suspicion, while it's still just an allegation. But I think specifically for politicians, especially this high up of politicians, them just being able to govern while it is a suspicion that they could have done what they've done is terrible for our country.
The only clause that people are really looking at to kind of say, hey, this is in the Constitution, does it really like apply to people in the legislative branch, is actually the impeachment clause, which kind of, you know, was interpreted to always reference, you know, the executive branch, right? Your president, your vice president. And then people are kind of raising the question, well, should this kind of also apply to members of Congress too? Like, can you impeach a member of Congress? And I think it's kind of that discussion where, like, we know, not many people know this, but, you know, the Founding Fathers intended for the Constitution to kind of be rewritten every once in a while and be changed. Like, that's why we have the amendment process, and that was kind of their original intention. Do you think, like, a clause like that or should exist where maybe we could impeach, like, congressmen for very serious offenses?
I'm surprised the clause already doesn't exist to impeach congressmen. And I figured some sort of removal process was like already present. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I mean, at the moment, people are saying like for the Democrats to, you know, remove him from the Judiciary Committee. But at the end of the day, that's really, you know, nothing
not from
happening.
Position. Yeah, you can. There is a process to remove individual from a committee. We saw that earlier this year with
Marjorie Taylor Greene.
She was removed from the Education Committee, I want to say.
I believe so.
Mistaken on that one. Yeah, it was the Education Committee. So there's a process of removing a representative or whatnot from the committee, but nothing as of now for a process of removing them from their actual position as a congressman. But I want to go back to more of, you know, like Matt Gaetz's, like his individual response. A lot of the narrative he's been trying to spin is that this is some kind of deep state attack on his character, where his allegations are, you know, untrue, and it's like a sting operation made by the deep state. And this has really been echoed by the QAnon conspiracy theorists. And what I find, I guess you could call it ironic, is that QAnon's main, you know, conspiracy theory is that politicians and people in power have this, you know, child trafficking sex ring that they're participating in. And meanwhile, when we have actual evidence and allegations of a congressman participating in such acts, because he's on the side of those conspiracy theorists, they are, you know, the first to say, hold on, we need more evidence.
I think, you know, moving on a little bit, something that really does deserve to be talked about is the recent news where Matt Gaetz's close friend Joel Greenberg has been convicted guilty of separate crimes, and from what, you know, we currently know, is definitely considering to take a plea deal against Matt Gaetz, right? I think that if that plays out, where he's from the evidence we have, you can kind of assume that he's most likely guilty, right? But if that plays out, how do you think that's going to affect, you know, the people who supported these two? Because at the end of the day, they kind of were like an iconic duo.
it's important to contextualize. So that we have evidence of Matt Gaetz giving, I believe it was Venmo payments or some kind of online transaction or transfer of money.
Bring that up, and I had a Greenberg. Joke for it. So I'm going to cut you off and say it now. And you can continue after. I think the like a proper analogy for a congressman or senator representative using Venmo to child traffic is the equivalent of a drug dealer cashing out a check to his dealer for drugs, and that's number three on the bar from Stolen from SNL, but that was in the comment section.
Oh, okay.
He's stolen from the comments now too.
Back to what I was saying. So we have I believe it was Venmo. It might have been Zelle. I don't remember exactly. Yeah, it was Venmo. So we have, you know, these Venmo records of Matt Gaetz transferring money into Joel Greenberg, right?
Joel Greenberg's
account. I believe I'm saying that right. Yeah, Joel Greenberg's account. So there's obviously some kind of transaction going on there. We'll get, you know, for once if there's a subpoena and investigation, we'll get more evidence as to exactly, you know, what that transaction was for. But we do know that there's evidence of a transaction between the two.
The transaction, the same amount of money was also like the exact same amount of money that he sent to Mr. Greenberg's Venmo was put into three separate, I think it was 17-year-old Venmo account labeled like the same amount of money labeled tuition and school. And if that's not the most suspicious thing in the history of politics, then I can't tell you what it is.
Yeah, a lot of, like, I mean, the facts seem to really be lining up against Matt Gaetz and Joel Greenberg as well. So, but, you know, once we get a subpoena investigation, well, more things will definitely become more clear, coming to light. But as it stands right now, there seems to be, the puzzle pieces seem to be fitting a little bit too well.
Right? And I guess talking about people possibly standing trial with the subpoena, we can talk about a current trial that's currently happening. That was the word current too much. Anyways, a current trial happening in the United States and probably the most overseen trial since OJ, however many years back, is the Derek Chauvin trial, where obviously, as you know, he's being tested on trial for the senseless murder of George Floyd. Jaden, can you provide the context?
Of course. So as you know, we've already talked about in the past when it comes to, the killing of George Floyd, Officer Chauvin was the one who directly put his knee on George Floyd, and what, you know, the evidence is showing and many people are saying is the one who kind of directly led to his death. And here we are, almost, you know, a year into the future where, you know, he's going on trial. And this trial is kind of between Chauvin and his defense, who's kind of saying, hey, Chauvin was not directly responsible for his death, right? You can't prove that, you know, it was his knee that actually caused the death. It could be so many other things, right? And we'll talk about, you know, what those other things are. And then you also have the prosecution who's saying, clearly putting your neck on someone or putting your knee on someone's neck for that long is going to cause death.
So I have a very, I don't want to say super extensive, but a very hefty rant on this thing. But first, I want to talk about, or real briefly, the fact that it took a year for this trial to actually begin. And if it took that long for a trial to happen for a police officer, imagine the length of the trial prior to Matt Gaetz's, assuming it happens, surrounding his allegations and the fact that he is able to stand his position is enormously horrendous. Anyways, as ridiculously terrible as this is, I think the prosecution is facing an uphill battle in the Derek Chauvin trial, only because in any case of this matter, as horrible as it is, and I want to stress that, it is an uphill battle because the defense can very easily make a case for reasonable doubt, right?
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. I think just in any court case, like another flaw with our legal system is it's a lot more difficult for the prosecution than it is for the defense. Because the prosecution has to prove, you know, I mean, the prosecution has to prove that, you know, this did happen, right? But the defense doesn't have to prove that, oh, this didn't happen or this didn't happen that way. They could just say, you know, this might have happened. You can't really, like, they don't have to prove that nothing actually happened. They can just say, you know, their story is not lining up. You know, a couple things may be wrong. Like, if the prosecution says, oh, yes, this happened on a Monday, and the defense can say, oh, you know, this happened on a Tuesday, actually, right? Then technically, the defense would therefore win that argument because they presented the flaw in the prosecution's argument.
Exactly. And I think in typical like judiciary proceedings, I think it makes more sense for the prosecution to have a harder battle But in cases as severe as this, or in general, they need to raise the standard of reasonable doubt just a little bit to not even the playing field, but to make cases like this where it's very like unsure, to make it you know more in favor of the prosecution, just like generally a little bit. But I think the case for reasonable suspicion, to I guess broaden the context a little bit, the case for reasonable doubt stems from the fact that the cause of death was ruled asphyxiation, and the prosecution witness, the doctor, claimed through the defense's cross-examination that asphyxiation can potentially happen from a drug overdose, even though it possibly didn't. The defense can make a case of reasonable doubt that it was, right? Or that the fact that there was a possibility that there was. And recently they found evidence of 2 fentanyl pills in the police car where George Floyd was at first put in and then removed from. And finally, the fact that in the original car where George Floyd was pulled over, his dealer was allegedly there, but refused to stand trial on fear of self-incrimination. So with these pieces, as horrible as it is, and I cannot stress this enough, the defense can make a case for reasonable doubt, and there is a possibility that the verdict cannot go the way the public obviously wants it to go.
I mean, of course, there's always a possibility that a verdict can go either way. I mean, there's no 100% guarantee for either defense or prosecution to claim victory in this trial. However, I think the argument of reasonable doubt is a little bit facetious, simply for the fact that even if it was a drug overdose, one, I mean, I think the possibility of it being a drug overdose is a little bit unreasonable. But even still, having, you know, I mean, I think the majority of the public by now has seen, at least the American public by now has seen the footage from the police from the event, and they, you know, having you know a knee on your neck with what it looks like to be the majority of Chauvin's body weight, at least that's what it appears to look like, is, you know, the majority of his body weight being pressed onto George Floyd's neck. That is, I mean, obviously that is prime reason for asphyxiation when you're having, you know, probably 150 or so pounds being, you know, applied to the back of your neck and lying down. Of course, that is prime reason for asphyxiation. But even if, you know, he might have fentanyl in the system, if you have, you know, this is kind of the analogy I've been using, where if you have a heart attack, you know, because someone is choking you, yes, the heart attack killed you, but the causality of the matter is that it's the choking that caused you to have the heart attack, and it's the blood is on the person choking his hands. So I think it's more of a causality issue than anything else. And, you know, regardless of reasonable doubt, I think the jury will, you know, it'll be a difficult decision, of course, but I think the jury will decide that the, you know, having the knee on the neck was definitely the prime reason for George Floyd's death, and they will I think at least they will rule in favor of the prosecution.
I actually don't want to be as quick to say that I feel that the jury is going to rule one way or the other, because I think we've never really seen a situation just like this where everybody has seen it before. Everybody knows what's going on, right?
In Los Angeles, that exact case, right? It was, yeah. Are you aware of the Rodney King case? It was another example of police brutality where Rodney King was pulled over. He was an activist for black culture, right? And he was promptly stopped from his car and beat by police officers who killed him, and then they were ruled innocent, right? So obviously it wasn't as overseen as the George Floyd incident, but it's not something that's uncommon. And again, with Jaden's claim that like we can't just immediately say he was ruled guilty only because it was so like odd, like this man was like the most hated man in the world right now, right?
Exactly. But even still, like there's never been, like, the whole world is watching, right? That's what I'm talking about when I say there's never been a scenario in a situation like this where everybody kind of knows what's going on and everybody has their eyes on this specific moment. Because, like I said, I don't want to be as quick to say, like, even if we all, like, I know we all feel that he deserves to be, you know, charged as guilty, but I don't think it's going to be that easy of a decision for the jurors, because all we really have to go off, like, right now is kind of the historical precedent of these, like, police-type court case events. And in many cases, the jury has actually acquitted the police officer, which I think is why you kind of have to be hesitant, like, in a scenario like this, even though, like, it should be as clear as ever to say, okay, this guy caused George Floyd's death. But I think you still have to be hesitant, and you can't just kind of rush to those conclusions, because in cases like this, it's the sad truth that police officers, more times than not, don't always, you know, face the justice that they deserve to face.
I really quickly want, like, obviously continue with the discussion, but I really want to go back to what Evan said about how it's a matter of causation. When you gave your analogy of someone's being choked out and they have a heart attack, and it was very obvious that the choking person evidently causes heart attack due to asphyxiation and whatnot, right? I don't know if this instance, I don't know the legal proceedings, if this instance is going to cause some sort of like lesser sentence, but do you think that there is some amazing miracle possibility? I don't want to say miracle because that implies a good thing, but some like ridiculously small possibility that the person just happened to have a heart attack at the same time that they were being choked out.
I mean, possibility, yes. But I think at that, right? I think it's a minimum of manslaughter at that point.
I think a better example, rather than like, you know, being choked and that causing a heart attack, is if a person had underlying like issues with their respiratory system, right? But then they were choked and they died because of, you know, they couldn't breathe, they lost, you know, they weren't able to breathe, they couldn't catch their breath, right? Even though they did have underlying conditions with their respiratory system, it's still at the end of the day them being choked that actually caused their death, right? Like, you kind of have to paint the picture as, I mean, yeah, you kind of have to paint the picture as, like, if that person was not choked, or if Officer Chauvin didn't have his knee on George Floyd, would he have died?
Okay, very likely the case is no. He wouldn't have died if the knee was not on his neck. And I think we can all agree to that. But the defense's case, at least at the moment, is that there has to exist some amazing implies good, but amazingly small possibility that there is a reasonable world in which George Floyd, if the knee of Derek Chauvin was not put on his neck, that he would have died from an overdose, and it just happened to be like a wrong place at a wrong time for Chauvin's knee to be on his neck. That is very obviously untrue, but the defense is making a case that it's technically reasonable, right? And that's where the lines go from black and white to in the middle gray, right?
Yeah.
And that's where it can't be absolutely said that he's guilty or absolutely said that he's innocent. It's a case of who makes the better argument.
So moving on kind of to a different note, there are kind of like two things I think we really should touch on. The first one being, what do we think is going to happen and be the reaction if he is found not guilty?
I think there's going to be a backlash of riots, reminiscent of right when it happened. And I think they're going to happen at an exponentially larger scale, because not only is this displaying that our judiciary system and government in general has a immense flaw, and it's ridiculously exposing that, more so than it was exposing it when he just got arrested, right? Because right when the incidents happened, he was promptly arrested, and all the proper proceedings that I guess they wanted to happened, where he got arrested and whatnot. But if and the riots were still to protest the judiciary system, right?
Yeah.
And their claims of the rioters or protesters are going to effectively be true if he was acquitted. So it's going to motivate them even more, is what I'm trying to say.
See, I disagree on the aspect that it will be at a larger scale than the original ones that we saw back in December 2020. I disagree because I think sort of that, like, I don't know if spark is the right word, but, you know, that, like, that real driving force, it's not lost, but it's not nearly as prevalent as it was back then. I think plenty of people will definitely be upset. I think plenty of people will definitely be, you know, protesting and rioting and whatnot. But I don't think we're going to see it at the same level or degree that we saw it back in summer of 2020, just because it really, you know, it's been, you know, almost a year. You know, a lot of people have, I don't want to say they've moved on, but they've, you know, that's kind of what happens when it comes to these kind of things, where unfortunately there are people who kind of latch on the trend and then they will move on. And I think because of that, it won't necessarily be as large of a of a protest or whatnot, as compared to at least what we saw back in, you know, summer of 2020.
I mean, I fundamentally disagree, because I think I sound like Ben Shapiro when I talk super fast and stuff. I think the motivation back then, or the spark, as you put it, was the loss of George Floyd. I think if he was acquitted, the motivation for riots would be revenge, because of the fact that he got acquitted. And I think a revenge riot would spark more anger than a mournful riot, if that makes sense.
I definitely think that, you know, when it, like, if there were to be some sort of, like, response via, like, protest or riot, the issue back in the summer of 2020 was, okay, our justice system is failing us, like, this is a flaw in our, like, government and our society, right? And now going into, you know, after he is acquitted or found guilty, like, in the scenario that he is acquitted, right, those still issues are still going to be as prevalent. I think it kind of should lead, you know, all of the United States to this discussion. But for us three here today, how do we feel about the current state of, like, the U.S. justice system? Because I know personally, I think that we talked about already, it's a very flawed system to have the defense only required to prove that there is a simple, like, small flaw in the prosecution's argument. I think a much better approach to something like this is the defense actually should kind of be required to prove that what the prosecution is saying did not happen, right? Not that, you know, there's a small, like, blip in their argument, but what they are saying is inherently false, right? I think that's where we should move to. I doubt it's going to happen because, you know, there are definitely a lot of people who serve to benefit off of our current system, but I think that you definitely can point out the very clear flaws in the system we have right now.
I think some reform in the justice system needs to be made, but I don't know, having an empirical evidence to why the prosecution's case did not happen is the right solution, because if that were to be implemented, it'd be just to juxtapose how it is right now and how it is how it would be with that system. How it is right now is too many people who are, like, actually committed a crime are walking free. In that other instance that you proposed, where the defense has to empirically, like, disprove the prosecution's argument, you're gonna be left with a world where too many innocent people are put in jail. And which one would you rather have, more guilty people walking free or more innocent people in jail?
I mean, if people are guilty and they didn't commit a crime, then I think if they're convicted of a crime, the defense surely shouldn't have an issue of, you know, proving that they didn't commit the crime if they didn't commit the crime in the first place, right? I think now, yes, we do have a lot of people who are guilty walking free, but I don't think that if we were to move towards, like, a system like that, we'd inherently see a lot of, you know, innocent people being locked up, because that still does happen today. But if you're innocent, the defense now doesn't have to prove innocence. They just have to, like, if their client is completely guilty, they can just say, okay, you know what, here's an error in their case there. But I think the defense actually having to prove innocence is going to be kind of a more thorough process to make sure that guilty people are charged and innocent people remain being innocent.
Well, see, this kind of goes down to the fundamental argument of innocent until proven guilty or guilty until proven innocent, where, because our justice system is rooted on the basis that, you know, we believe all are innocent until proven guilty, that's why the burden of proof is on the prosecution and why the defense just has to find that, you know, blip, as Jaden referred to it as. But I think, you know, that scenario that Jaden presented, where it's, you know, defense has to prove innocence, that goes against the very fundamental idea of innocent until proven guilty. And I don't think, in my ideas or in my thoughts, I don't think that, you know, having to prove innocence is the most healthy way of doing it, of having a justice system, at least compared to what we have now.
Do you not think that system could operate where, you know, we still have innocent until proven guilty, right? Where if someone convicted walks into a courtroom, they are still innocent, right? And the prosecution is going to try and prove them guilty, but instead of the defense, because the defense doesn't prove that people are innocent now. That's the issue I have, right? The defense does not need to prove that you did not commit a crime for you to, you know, be acquitted or, you know, not found guilty of that crime.
The issue I have with this whole argument is the assumption that, you know, the defense has it easy, that, you know, they just have to find the small little 1% issue.
It's still difficult. Really, I just think
it's really an oversimplification of how our system works.
It is an oversimplification.
And I think it's really mostly popularized through sensationalist media. You know, this idea that, like, oh, maybe the weapon he used was a centimeter different than what they was said. Like, that's completely absurd, and a really just an oversimplification of how the defense and prosecution system, or how our judicial system works with those, you know, with the multifaceted, you know, situation that it is.
Armand, I know you want to talk, but really quickly, let me ask you this, Evan. Do you not think that when it comes to, you know, court cases, it is currently an uphill battle for the prosecution, right? Yeah, it's not currently an uphill battle for the prosecution.
I mean, to say that it's an uphill battle for one side or the other is completely arbitrary because every case is different. I mean, you have uphill battles no matter what side you're on. To be fair, if someone's innocent and they're being prosecuted, it's an uphill battle for the prosecution. If someone's guilty, it's an uphill battle for the defense. There is no one or the other answer there. It's just dependent on the case. So to say it's an uphill battle regardless of who is being on trial is completely absurd, in my opinion. But I don't want to... You know.
I have some things to say. It is and it will always be an uphill battle for the prosecution. Because in cases where people are innocent until proven guilty, the prosecution's goal is to prove them guilty while the defense's goal is to just maintain their innocence. And in any given scenario, whether it be in the judiciary system or literally anything, maintenance of an idea is, like a status quo in general, is a lot easier than trying to disprove it. Done. Now, Jaden's case, right? He talked about how the idea of reasonable doubt is a little like ridiculous because the defense should have to create a case to why there's not doubt in the prosecution's case but why they are innocent, correct?
Yes.
I agree with Evan in that refutation where it idolizes guilty till proven innocent, which is like a polar opposite to innocent till proven guilty. But I do think the reasonable doubt scenario is a little less of what it should be, and we talked about that previously already, right?
Yeah.
And your justification for that is I'm going to refute that now. Sorry, I have so many thoughts in my head. In a case, and your refutation was if an innocent person is innocent, they should have no problem creating a case as to why it's innocent, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're never presented in a judiciary hearing with all the evidence. More likely than not, there's always going to be some lost or unsure evidence. That's just a matter of conflicting opinions, right? So in that sort of case, it's going to be a lot easier for the, I know I can see Evan smile.
I'm not sure where we're going with this. Actually, that's the thing.
All right. In a case where there are, in most cases, where there's a lack of like all the evidence present, where a lot of them are just like conflicting stories, I guess, it's I feel at least that a jury is far likely going to become appealed to a narrative created by the prosecution where, oh, all this happened and this led to this and this led to this and then he did commit the crime. More likely so when the defense has to try and build an opposing narrative where this happened to this and this happened to this and this happened to this and this is then he didn't commit the crime, right? It's a very loose thought. It's not super condensed, but do you sort of see where I'm going with this? How the jury will far likely appeal to a prosecution narrative if it's an instance where the defense actually has to build a case as to why he's innocent, right?
Yeah, I understand that. That's a really fair point.
Well, with all that said, we want to once again thank you for watching this episode of the Gradient Podcast. As always, you were joined today with myself, Evan.
Jaden.
And the person whose SNL joke counter is stuck at 3. I'm Armand.
We're thinking 3.
Yeah, probably if you around found any more, 3.
If you found any more stolen jokes, please be sure to leave in the comments. But, of course, if you enjoyed the episode and if you enjoy our content, make sure to like, comment, subscribe, and share our YouTube videos. You can find us on social media pages. Our Instagram is @GradientPodcast. Our Facebook, @GradPod. Our Twitter, also @GradientPodcast. If you are a Reddit user, we have our newly minted subreddit r/gradientpodcast. You can go ahead and be the first one to post because there are still no posts, so if you're listening and you want to be the first one to post, get, you know, farm some good karma. r/gradientpodcast on Reddit is our official subreddit. Is there anything else?
And other good Gradient news, in the first time in Gradient history, we have a stockpile of episodes, so now there's absolutely no excuse for new episodes to come out, so that's always a good thing.
Yep, no excuse.
No excuse.
And that stockpile, you have to thank me and Jaden for pushing Evan to stay awake till 1:09 in the morning.
Listen, it's late. I'm pretty late, but it's not usually doing podcasts. Mm-hmm.
Well, never too late to podcast.
Never too late to podcast. That's a motto. Put that on a t-shirt. Well, you know, right? we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Gradient Podcast. If you like us, stick around and subscribe. You can always be sure to find new episodes coming out soon. Have a nice day.
Thank you so much.
And that's a wrap.
Why do we say then that's a wrap?
A chicken salad wrap. We'll be right back.